Let's remember, start off with a little reminder. Let's remember what the Israelites have heard from Joshua, from Moses, even as God is trying to express his desires for them. What they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to think, especially when they're in the land, when they're in the promised land and at rest and peace, flowing with milk and honey. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. That's pretty big. That's pretty big. It's hard to contemplate. It's hard to think of, are we doing that today in our lives? Is He our everything? In utter humility before God, obey Him. Why do we disobey? Most of the time, it's because what we're told doesn't make sense to us. Well, that's pride. That's pride. Be humble. Don't compromise with or tolerate the philosophies of the world around you. That's what they were told. They were supposed to go in and wipe everything out. I mean, totally destroy all of these religious symbols. They let them stand. And then they compromised. Well, that looks intriguing. It looks enticing. They compromised. Can you, philosophically, theologically, doctrinally, destroy the philosophies of the world around you? Do you know how to argue, at least for your own benefit, if not for those around you, with the philosophies of the world? Do you know that they're, do you know their downfalls? Do you know their entrapments? Do you know their deceptions? So that as your family and friends are falling prey to them, you can come alongside and say, hey, this is where you're going wrong. This is what's so harmful. They're supposed to drive out all the inhabitants of the land. Either destroy utterly these people groups or drive out utterly those people groups, and they let them remain. They let them remain. This one just is mind-boggling. After all some of them had seen in the desert and coming into the land, they were supposed to teach their children well. Teach their children well. And they didn't. I was at a funeral yesterday, and I know very well the faith of the great-grandparents and the grandparents that were in the room, and to see its absence in the generations, the parents and the children that were in there. Just, it was one of the more depressing funerals I've been to in a long, long time. The people in the room had no idea what had happened before. And that's what these people did. They didn't teach their children well. It says another generation came up. They didn't know God. They had been told, live by faith and not by sight. How well do we do that? When you see your checkbook, or you see the bills, or you see the neighbors, or you see the broken relationships, or you have the confusion and the doubts, how well do we live by faith and not by sight? Here's these two incredible verses. Two incredible verses. And if these two verses don't sort of make you at least stop and ponder, wonder, contemplate your own life and your own faith, there's something wrong. They're actually terrifying verses. You have to remember who we're talking about and what they had seen. And early in Judges, we have Judges 2:10. there arose another generation after them. Caleb, Joshua, after them. There arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work he had done for Israel. That's terrifying. And that's our one bookend at the beginning of Judges, and then we have this other one, the end of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. My children, very obedient children, what would my family look like if they just did whatever was right in their own eyes? What would that be like? Have you seen families like that, by the way? I saw a couple yesterday at this funeral. The kids were just doing whatever they want. How about a church like that? Frequently, someone will say, "Hey, Pastor or Joanna, we have a question for you. I got a question for you. What do you think about this?" And we'll say, "Well, according to the Word, or here's this principle that we have here." "I don't think that." "Well, then why are you asking me?" "That's not the way I see it. That's not my opinion." "Well, then keep your own opinion. Don't ask me." What if this church, this family gathering, ran, everybody does and follows whatever they believe is right in their own eyes? How would that work? It's been tried. It's been tried. Things went very well under Joshua. Things went very well under Caleb. The other leaders of that generation. And then God tells Joshua, "I'm waiting to hear this. I'm eager to hear this. You're getting old." "Thank you, Lord, please. There's still work to be done. Divide it. Send them off to finish the work." "Oh, thank you, God." You know, retirement in his system is awesome. So Joshua divides the land into these 12 portions, these 12 regions. And he tells them, "Finish the work. You've got to finish the work that I began. You've got to do it." 31 kings and their people or their cities Joshua has defeated. "Finish it," he says. And they don't. I mean, it is like immediate epic failure. They fail, they disobey, they live by sight. And this brings us to the first cycle that we talked about last week. I introduced two cycles. How many of you remember both of them really well and want to repeat them? Yeah, I didn't think so. Huh? Yes, we have a bicycle with two wheels and a tricycle with... There you go. The first cycle is this. Listen, sometimes when I'm up here, I enjoy expressing what's here and what I've learned and what I've studied. And especially as we're going through this again, how I've learned this over the past 10 years since I first learned it. You understand? This is a neat thing for me. But as I stand here, I wonder where your brain is. What are you thinking about? Are you engaged? You know why? Because I've sat there an awful lot and thought about football. Okay? So I'm wondering, are you engaged? Listen to these two cycles. Get these two cycles. These two cycles are very, very important for your life. They allowed the enemy to remain. They used the enemy because it seemed technologically advanced, convenient. They imitated the enemy. Let's try it out their way. They embraced the enemy. Intermarried. They obeyed the enemy. You've been here longer than we have. You're in charge. You have the strongholds. And then the enemy owned them. The enemy oppressed them. That's the first cycle. And the biggest step in this, you are not going to get to oppression if you don't allow the enemy to remain. The biggest step was they allowed the enemy to remain. It's a cycle for them. And doggone it if we don't see them, this nation, go through it over and over and over and over and over again for hundreds of years. The same thing. It's called neurotic. Definition of insanity. Over and over and over again. It's a cycle of sin. This is the cycle of sin in their life, in their nation, and it's the cycle of sin that we embrace. The second cycle that we see starts with disobedience. That's sin. It's kind of like a cycle within a cycle. Disobedience. And then God removes his hand of blessing and imparts his hand of discipline. And that discipline can be pretty severe. He is not trying to crush, destroy, wipe them out. He's trying to get their attention. What are the desert places in our life for? The difficult areas, the hard areas, the parched and dry areas get our attention. What are the blessed places for? Get theirs. But here, he removes his hand of blessing and says, okay, discipline. He's a good God. He's unwilling to let us continue on in our own selves. So he imparts discipline, and they go, it's so hard. It's so difficult. And they have despair over it. The shocking thing to see so many times is they're not in despair because of their sin. We did it. I can't believe we were so dumb. I mean, have you guys ever had these moments in your lives where you've stepped back and go, what an idiot was I? I can't believe it. In our family, we say, own it. Own it. Tell my kids, my wife tells me, you know, I mean, go deal with it. You did it. Go deal with it. They're not having that moment. Look what we did. They're having the moment, this is so hard, why? When you are in your difficult places, are you ever asking why? Wrong question. Ask what? What is God trying to draw your attention to? You know that I am not preaching, live well and God will bless you. That is not you. If you think that's what's going on here, you are in the wrong church. I am saying that our difficult places, our hard places, especially when they seem as though they are from the hand of God. I've had the moments in my life where it seems like it's just part of life and life is difficult. And I've had the moments in my life where I'm like, Joanna, this is from God. We did something. Don't ask why. Don't you care? Don't you understand? Don't you understand? Don't you see? Don't go through this. Ask what? What are you trying to draw my attention to? See, that's their problem. They're not asking the what. They're just, oh, this is so hard. They're in their despair. And God loves them. And he has a soft heart for them. And he realizes he's gotten their attention. He's gotten their attention. People are giving the message. This is why. Things are being heard among the nation. And then he sends a deliverer. He sends deliverance from their difficulty. So you need to remember these two cycles very, very well. The first cycle, I'm just going to summarize. What you allow to remain in your life will oppress you, if not enslave you. And the second cycle is real simple, and we did all D's, okay? Disobedience, discipline, despair, and then deliverance. Two things you should really think about, ponder. There's one more thing that I want you to look at before we get into Judges chapter 3. You need to remember what the people in the land believe. It's important to know what your neighbors, your friends, your relatives believe. You need to know what these people in the land believed. You need to know who they worshipped and why. You need to know how the Israelites started to participate in the system. You need to understand how the system came to own the Israelites again. Just like in Egypt, the people in the land of Canaan have a pantheon. They have a plurality of gods, many, many different gods. But as far as the Canaanites go, Baal is the chief god. His name actually means son of God. Has it ever struck you how many cultures have a deity who is called the son of God? Even the Romans began to believe that the Caesar was the son of God. It's interesting. Baal is the son of God, and he is seen as the god of the storm. His voice is heard in thunder. His power is seen in lightning. And he brings lots of rain. Rain for the rivers and the sea to give them borders and protect them. And rain for the land to give them prosperity. Now, Baal has a mistress named Ashtoreth. And she is seen as the goddess of pleasure and indulgence. Debauchery, we would call it. They together have a son named Beelzebul, translated Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies. But these two, Baal and Ashtoreth, they are worshipped in the most debaucherous of ways. Looks a little like this. The priests are going to dance around, and they're in this chaotic frenzy. Dancing and swinging and bouncing and jumping and bumping. It's crazy. And they're slashing themselves with knives or sharpened stones, this bloodletting. I can imagine this going on all day in the worship of Baal and Ashtoreth. And the people who are going there to worship are participating in this worship with prostitutes. And if you have been blessed in the last year with a child, you're going to bring that child to this place of worship where these people are bloodletting and participating in prostitution, and you're going to sacrifice that child live in a fire. I know it might be hard for you sitting here in our very civilized Western culture to imagine a culture that indulges in the destruction of the mind. I know it might be hard for you sitting here this morning in a nice, cool room, clean, and to imagine a culture that indulges in the destruction of the body. And I know it might be hard for you sitting here in this righteous place, sanctified, to imagine a culture that indulges in sexual immorality. And I know it might be hard for you sitting here this morning, quiet, peaceful, listening to a great sermon, to imagine a culture that will sacrifice its own children for the convenience and betterment of the family. But that's what you have to wrap your mind around. This is what they were doing. Now, to this system, we add the Philistines, because they're not Canaanites. They've come to this land, and they live in those five cities on the coasts, and they bring with them their god, Dagon. Now, Dagon is god of gods in their world, and as these two cultures sort of clash and then mesh, Dagon becomes seen as the father of Baal, whose mistress is Ashtoreth, whose child is Beelzebub. So there you have it. This should be completely abhorrent to the Israelites. This life, these practices, these beliefs, these philosophies should be disgusting to them, gut-wrenching. But instead, it allures them. What allures you from the world around you? It entices them. What entices you? It enslaves them. What habits do you have in your life that you can't seem to break? What habits are going on in your head, in your body, in your heart that seem to have a hold over you? Now, let's get to Joshua chapter 3. We're going to do something a little different. We're not just going to go up right through the chapter. We're going to look at the three scenarios that we see of enslavement, and then we're going to look at the three scenarios that we see of deliverance from the enslavement. The first scenario is right there in Joshua 3, chapter 7. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Judges. Chapter 3, verse 7. Judges. Chapter 3, verse 7. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Ashtoreths. So we have all these idols and posts all over the land of Canaan, and wherever the Israelites are settling, they're starting to worship all these idols. And in that way, in that manner, then the anger of the Lord was kindled. That's not a good day. This is not a good thing against Israel. So here we go. He removes his hand of blessing and he imparts his hand of discipline. This first time he uses a Hittite warrior king. The king's name is Cushan-Rishathaim. I've got it written out phonetically, so I know I can say it properly. And you're probably going to come and say I didn't say it the right way anyways. You don't know. You don't know. Cushan-Rishathaim. It literally means Cushan of double wickedness. I mean, this guy is such a bad guy. This guy is bad as bad. This guy is a nasty, nasty guy. The Hittites, they're the third most powerful people group, empire, in that region. First would be Egypt, second would be Mesopotamia, then you have the Hittites. What the Hittites have done under this king is they have taken over and conquered Mesopotamia. And so they're going to sweep down from Mesopotamia as they want to go and attack Egypt. So they come over here, pop these guys, they want to come south towards Egypt. Guess who's in the way? Israel's in the way. Israel would also be a really good place to stop, regroup, revive yourself before you attack Egypt. So the Hittites end up occupying Israel and oppressing the Israelites for 8 years. The Hittites under Cushan-Rishathaim oppress Israel. Scenario number two, Judges 3, verse 12. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. I love that word, again. So he removes his hand of blessing and imparts his hand of discipline. And this time he's going to use a Moabite king named Eglon. King Eglon. Eglon's interesting. He's a Moabite, but he has an alliance, an allegiance, a peace treaty with the Amalekites and the Amorites. So now you've got a problem. You have three of these people groups lining up against Israel. Moabites, Amalekites, and Amorites. It's interesting because the Moabites and the Amorites are descendants of Lot. And the Amalekites are the descendants of Esau. So you have these first and second and third cousins. Maybe fourth, fifth, tenth, twentieth, I don't know. They're all family in there. Some way they all go back to the same ancestors, but these three are lining up against this one. King Eglon, he sees the significance of that city Jericho. The walls fell down. He sees the significance. He says, well, that's right in the right place. And he comes in and he takes the city. And he builds a huge, well-fortified palace in this huge, well-fortified city there, by now, rebuilt. It's interesting, by the way, 1933, archaeologists found Eglon's palace in Jericho. And he's going to have them pay tribute to them. Taxes. I know you're so eager to pay taxes. You love your taxes. Some of you pay more taxes than you have to, just for fun, because you love big government. So you say, here, take it all. Eglon is saying, bring it all in. And emissaries from all the tribes and all the families and all the clans are sent to bring their taxes in and pay him tribute there. And the third scenario is you have these Philistines. These Philistines are interesting because they don't just conquer and take over. They love this. They do raiding parties into the Israelite areas. They let the Israelites farm. And when it's all harvested in, they come in and take it all. Why would you conquer a people group who is getting you all the food and flocks you need? Let them go out there and farm and harvest and grow the flocks and then come and take them. So they have the people enslaved as well. These people are working and working and working and working and never having the benefit of their own work. They're having to try and hide it and it's still stolen. They're constantly taunting. The other thing that you need to remember too is while the Hittites and the Philistines both have iron weapons, it's the Philistines who won't let the Israelites have iron. Because 1 Samuel 13:19 says, now, no blacksmith could be found in all of Israel because the Philistines have said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords and spears. So you have these three scenarios. And God is quite literally saying, okay, you believe the system around you can protect you? You're engaging in it? You believe the system around you can provide for you? You're worshiping in this? You believe the system around you can bless you and make your life prosperous and easier? So you participate in the system of the world around you? Okay, have it. You can have all of the system of the world around you because eventually the system of the world around you is going to have you. Takes his hand of blessing off, brings the discipline, and they cry out. They cry out because of their oppression. Now, here, those are the first three scenarios. Let's look at the scenarios of deliverance. Deliverance to scenario number one, Othniel, the son of Kenaz. We first see Othniel in Joshua chapter 15. Caleb, Joshua and Caleb. Caleb offers his daughter in marriage to any warrior who can defeat the city of Debir. And Othniel is the warrior who defeats the city of Debir. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he judged Israel and he went out to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand so that he prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. He wins and their oppression, their enslavement is relieved. Deliverance for scenario number two comes from a guy named Ehud. Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. Now, interesting, left-handed in Hebrew, it's not actually left-handed. That's the way we translate it. It literally should be translated into English, right-hand restricted. Left-handed in Hebrew means right-hand restricted. We know that the tribe of Benjamin, this particular family group, this particular clan, this tribe, has people who are either left-hand prominent, ambidextrous. Is anyone in here ambidextrous? Nobody really? Ambidextrous people are kind of neat. We've got no neat people in here. Okay, so they're either left-hand prominent or ambidextrous, and that gives them a lot of advantage in a fight. How many of you are familiar with fighting? Anyone? You got one? I get you, man. Less and less people are growing up on the street. I grew up on the street. The worst, most devastating injury I ever had came from a left-handed punch. A left-handed punch. I was watching boxing last night after having prepared this whole thing this week, and I was watching boxing. And there were these two great competitors. They were just about equal in everything, height, weight, reach, everything. Their records were so equal. One boxer was drawing back his right hand to deliver a punch, and the other boxer, where am I open, used his left hand, punched this guy, knocked him straight out. Left-handed punch, boom. Because you're right-handed, you're using it, leaves you completely open. So imagine a society in which this is very important. In a real fight with real swords and slings and spears and all, you know, I mean, this is a real problem when you come up against left-handed people. How many of you are left-handed? Y'all should learn how to fight. Because you take the rest of us out. The tribe of Benjamin, Judges 20 describes one point, just one point, where 700 Benjamite warriors, choice men who were left-handed, fought a battle. It's a very important strategic point. So Ehud is either disabled in his right hand, restricted in some way, or he's left-hand dominant. He straps a sword, a little dagger, 18 to 20 inches long, the inside of his right thigh. And he goes to pay tribute to Eglon. And he pays his tribute, puts the plunder down, and Eglon sees all this plunder. And then Ehud says to him, I have a message for you from God. It's interesting, quite a message. Now, he had been frisked. How many of you have been frisked? A couple of us, three of us, same three or four people. Some of you got to get a life. He's been frisked, he's been searched. They haven't found the dagger that's on the inside of his right thigh. So Eglon says, okay, a message from God, I need to hear this. And he dismisses everyone, feeling safe. He's been searched, we're safe. And the door's closed, and now it's just Ehud and Eglon. And he says, I need to whisper this to you. I need to get close to you, tell you, right, so no one else hears. It's a secret from God. Okay? And he gets up there, and he whips out this dagger, and he plunges it into Eglon's stomach. Now, Eglon, the Bible says, he is a very obese man. This dude is bigger than big. I'm a big guy. I'm over 6'1", I weigh 300 pounds, and I stood up against the wall this morning with a yardstick. I said, what is this? It's 13 inches, front to back, 13 inches. This is an 18 to 20 inch dagger. So you have to understand, this is imagery, right? I know the kind of stuff you guys watch on TV. I got to do a little bit of that here. This is imagery. 18 to 20 inch dagger. It just begins to come out of the guy's back just a little bit, but it is completely engulfed in the guy's front. The handle is submerged into the guy's stomach. So this is, if I'm 13 inches and I'm a big boy, this guy is about 18 to 20 inches, somewhere in there. He's a big, big boy. And Ehud does not want his sword back. he can keep it. So he closes and locks the doors. He locks those doors from the inside, and he crawls out a back window, and then he blows a horn. Everybody do it with me. Toot, toot, toot. Come on, one, everybody. Toot, toot. Come on, you toot. Hey, thanks. Okay. And then all his guys come out from where they were hiding, and they take the city, and 10,000 of Eglon's people die that day. It says he wiped out, not one escaped. wiped out the enemy, took Jericho back. That's our second scenario. And then our third deliverance is Shamgar of Anath. We don't know very much about Shamgar at all. But son of Anath, as it says in Scripture, is kind of confusing. Because one of the Canaanite deities in the pantheon of Canaanite gods is Anath. Shamgar is son of Anath. But we also have this place in Israel, there's a little city that's sort of similar called Beth-Anath. Beth-Anath. So Shamgar is either from this little city, Beth-Anath, or he's from a family. He's from a family that has given themselves over to Canaanite worship, or at least been influenced by Canaanite worship. And he's kind of poor. He doesn't have much. They don't have iron weapons. They're prevented from having weapons. They've been disarmed, the Israelites. Disarmament throughout history is always the first step to oppression. So not having any traditional weapons, he takes an ox goad. You guys know what an ox goad is? It's an 8-foot pole. I'm a little bit over 6 feet. I'm 6'1 and a quarter. Something. I used to be 6'2. I don't like the way this is going. I think I used to be 12 inches, but as I've come down a little bit, I'm 13, something like that. But eight feet, I imagine just about where that beam is. On one end, it has a very sharpened point, metal point of some sort. Probably copper point. On the other end, it has a flat spade that's been sharpened. Now, the point that you would use to move the ox, go this way, ox. Go that way, ox. I don't think the ox likes it, but he's not going to argue. The other end is to clean off the ox hoof to get the dirt out. So think about it. You've got an instrument, a farming implement, that prods, directs, and purifies. It directs and purifies. I found that interesting. You may not, but that's okay. And he uses this ox goad, this pole, says he struck down 600 Philistines with this pole. I used to think that there was probably a very strategic type of warfare, like the guerrilla type of warfare, where they're in the field doing their thing, moving ox to ox, and he sees them coming along, and he jumps out, pow, boom, goes back, and everybody's like, what happened? He's like, I don't know, I was doing an ox over here, you know. But I've been watching, because of my kids, more martial arts stuff. And I'm starting to think this is kind of like Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan. Things flying around and bah, 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 and 15, 20 people falling down. I think this is probably something spectacular to see. I think this is probably really maybe a supernatural thing rather than a strategic, covert, one-by-one thing. But either way, he pushes back the Philistines and delivers the Israelites from the Philistines' wrath. A couple things that I want you to go home considering. I really, 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 really want you to think about these two cycles. Two cycles. But I want you to go home remembering this. God can do anything he wants with anyone he wants. Anytime he wants to do it. You have the skilled warrior from the prominent family in Israel. You have a person who's either disabled and disadvantaged or at the very least unique. He's different. And then you have this rather obscure person who has very little at his disposal. All he has is what he has for farming. Who are you? Are you here? Are you chosen? Are you set aside, sanctified because of who you are? Are you the powerful? Are you the prominent? Are you the super skilled? Are you the disabled? Are you the unique? The different? Are you the disadvantaged? Are you the poor? The poor. The point is, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what you have at your disposal. All that matters is God and a submissive, willing, open heart. What's the result? Judges 3:11 says, the land had peace for 40 years. Scenario number one. Verse 30, again, the land had peace for 80 years. Scenario number two. Verse 30, all Israel was saved. Scenario number three. Rest. Peace. Rescue. Who are you? What have you allowed to remain? What part of the cycle are you in? And are you open to being used by God no matter what? No matter where, no matter how, no matter when.